I thought it was important to be here because the last time I was here to speak to the students of this university was, I think, on the night of Monday, September 13th, 1971, in Fillmore. And there may still be students here who were there then and will remember that terribly emotional night. It was before the announcement had been made by Dr. Edlin, the coroner of Monroe County in Rochester, that the 10 guards had not had their throats cut and had indeed been killed by state troopers and not by the inmates of the Attica Correctional Facility. Tonight is different, of course, because tonight is some 3.5 years after that night. We're still dealing with Attica, but dealing with it in a way which is irrelevant to life. Two men are on trial for the murder of the 11th Guard, William Quinn, who was wounded in the first half hour of the beginning of a rebellion, who was struck on the head and parts of his body by many inmates as the Times Square A gate at the Attica Correctional Facility, which had a defective bolt, gave way, and inmates suddenly in control of themselves for the first time in many a year for most of them, swarmed through that area, which is the central coordinating point of the entire prison, called Times Square, I guess, because so many of the inmates come from an area of the world in which Times Square is a geographical center. And William Quinn died as a casualty in a rebellion. And to try to make that into a microcosm of a murder case defies all logic, rationality, and decency. William Quinn was a victim of the state of New York, just as are John Hill and Charlie Joe Panassilis, just as everybody else of the 43 dead and the hundreds living was and is a victim of a society without any meaning, without any discernible values, without any hopes at the moment of any peaceful resolution of the malaise that grips us in this country, a malaise that exists on this campus, but exists off campus as well as on campus, a sudden, terrible realization that it's all lies and indecency and dross and power without significance virtually to any of us. And so we all are retreating rapidly into the private worlds of forgetfulness. For some it may be graduate school, for others it may be spectator sports, for others the television tube. But for most of us, whichever way we seek it, it is a withdrawal from political opposition, it's a withdrawal from controversy, it's a retreat to something I now well understand, and that is a retreat into a private decency so as not to be confronted with the public indecency. And of course, as you know, this is the way of the world across every American college campus. But it goes far deeper than just college campuses, because they are, after all, just one institutionalized variety of our life. It exists among those who are much older, exists throughout the middle class. It It stultifies people everywhere. And now, as we see the situation developing in the Near East, situation developing in Cambodia, in Vietnam, in so many other places, it makes it look as if all the sweat and blood of the 60s was all in vain. We're back on the same old road together. People talking of the domino theory of power politics, people talking of the fact that one country or another in Southeast Asia is indispensable to our national security, a whole beginning of involvement in a struggle that should have ended and would have ended and probably never would have begun but for our interference a long time ago. So it's good to be back here tonight, in a way, sad in another way, because in between essentially one era and the other lies this spectacle of Attica. And I have been involved in two situations in my life in which I participated in the original events that eventually became a trial. One was in a little hamlet in southwest South Dakota called Wounded Knee, and the other was in the Attica Correctional Facilities. In all of my other cases, I have been essentially a spectator, someone who comes in afterwards. I was not at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago when it took place. I came afterwards for the Chicago conspiracy trial, which just yesterday reached its last court decision. Now it will go into the bar associations and the appellate divisions and the other aspects of whether to discipline me or to disbar me or whatever else some people think ought to be done to me. But I think these two episodes of the Knee and D-Yard at Attica are intertwined. They're one event for me because they're both exactly the same. And maybe they are somewhat symbolic of what some people will do when there seems to be no other road to take. Maybe they are prophetic as to what may happen here in this country. They are the same episodes. There's little difference between a prison and a so-called Indian reservation. There's little difference between red men and women, paralyzed by centuries of not only neglect but outright oppression, a people with a suicide rate among its teenagers, which is the highest in the world, people whose per capita income is under $1,500 when the national poverty level is 3,000, a people decimated by disease induced by the white conquerors, blankets taken from dead smallpox victims and distributed among the Sioux tribes, as one example, a people debilitated by induced alcoholism, just as the British induced Chinese to become opium addicts, and we induce people dwelling in Harlem, Spanish or black, to become heroin addicts for political reasons. A people massacred, places bearing such distinguished American names as Sand Creek and Wounded Knee. A people reduced from a proud heritage to selling rugs on the streets of Santa Fe, New Mexico. Exploited, destroyed, paralyzed, made into relics of another day. And they, in contrast to the inmates of Attica, confined to a county and a half in South Dakota, of what was once called the Great Sioux Reservation, insured by treaty to range from the east bank of the Missouri River to the end of what is now the state of South Dakota, and to be theirs for as long as the grass shall grow and the river shall flow, as the Treaty of 1868 reads. And that all stripped away by the discovery of gold in the Black Hills, by white ranchers' greed, by the power companies and the other utilities, until it became only a county and a half in the most unarable section of South Dakota. And just 2,300 miles away in Attica, New York, there's another reservation. And compressed into another square of land were then 2,300 inmates, many of whom were just parole violators, young men, 19, 20, some of whom had been convicted of very serious crimes, most of whom had been denied adequate legal representation, who went to jail through a device known to us as plea bargaining, a method of convicting without a trial by the fear induced of a trial, and a circle of prison, back to the streets, back to prison, induced by this very mechanism of plea bargaining, joined in by most of the members of my profession and by the state. And in both of these places, Wounded Knee and Attica, revolutions began. In one, the landlords of this country were seeking some sort of a method by which to awaken people, to teach them that there was a spirit not dead yet, that there was a virtually extinct species that was going to save itself while we were watching out for the golden eagle. They were watching out for themselves. To bring to the attention of a country that prides itself on its ethics and morality, both of which are conspicuously lacking on any level, except the most individual, to teach such a country that a great indecency had been perpetrated in its name, and to say, in essence, as Tatanka Yotanka, Sitting Bull, had said on the eve of Little Bighorn, today is a good day on which to die. And in Attica Yard, the same refrain. If we cannot live as men, we will die as men. If we must live as animals, we can die as human beings. The same cry. Today is a beautiful day on which to die. If we cannot live as men, we will die as men. United by the same oppression that strings us all together if we only understood it. United by the sure knowledge that they were the oppressed and benighted and outcast of the world, that they had been forgotten by everyone else but themselves, and that the only way to live, to endure, was to fight and to seize whatever power there might be. In both places, hostages taken, 9 in Wounded Knee, some eventual 36 in Attica Yard. In both places, the law broken, the seizure of a village or the seizure of a prison yard. In both places, property damage. In both places, a manifesto of grievances. In both places, the power poised without to destroy. At Wounded Knee, the phantom jets, the armored personnel carriers, the M-16s, the flares that burnt half the place to the ground. At Attica, the dum-dum bullets of the state troopers, the helicopters, the gas. In one place, only 2 died. In the other place, 43 died. But the difference between 2 and 43 is probably no more than a quantitative and not a qualitative difference. And after both occurred, the great mass of us saying in one way or another, this is a terrible thing to break the law. Why couldn't they have used alternative methods? Why couldn't they have concentrated on electing someone in South Dakota or New York State who could have changed the picture? Why did they have to resort to force? There's too much force in the world. Evil begets evil. Wouldn't they have been better to have gone slower? Wouldn't they have been better to use the methods that we nice, white, middle-class people think are so efficacious and, of course, save us physical misery and preserve our property and our person? And yet none of those arguments made much sense to them any more than they made sense to Frelimo, people of Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, the people of Portugal and Cuba, to this country itself in this so-called anniversary we're going to have next year of our bicentennial of our mercantile revolution. And I guess the hardest thing to convince people is that there are others who do not believe that they possibly can be saved by the alternative methods offered by their more favored countrywomen and countrymen. And so they react in possibly the only way they can react. There is no power in a prison yard except the seizure of hostages. There is no power in South Dakota to Native Americans except the seizure of a town, an abbey in Wisconsin, a factory in New Mexico, Bureau of Indian Affairs building in Washington, Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, Alcatraz. There is no power in the powerless except that which they can seize for themselves. The other night at the law school at UB, there was a symposium in which I and a judge from Detroit Recorder's Court, Justin Ravitz, appeared, and there was a police officer by the name of Kirkland. Some of you have seen him on television with his program each week on Channel 7. And he, a black man, was talking to this overflow room of people in the moot courtroom at the law school. And this symposium was on the administration of criminal justice, or some high-flown title like that. And Mr. Kirkland got up and said to the people in front of him, this room full of 300, 400, 500 people, He said the hardest thing for all of us to understand is that we are all niggers. And then he said, there's one lesson that you better learn fast, that whether a man or a woman has a good job or no job, they get equally hungry. And that when they are hungry and they have no job, they are not going to die without a struggle. They're going to seize food. And that's a lesson, I guess it's hard for us, most of us coming out of a milieu which is middle class, predominantly white, very few of us really starved or even hungered. Virtually every want is in some way met. There isn't a gnawing feeling of eternal oppression. There isn't the reaction day in and day out of being despised, or at least feeling that you're being despised. There aren't the psychological trauma and the physical trauma of every day's living as a black person, or a poor white, or a Chicano field hand, or a Puerto Rican in Spanish Harlem, or a Native American, or a woman. Many of you have felt the last more than the rest, and it's every bit as deep and as pertinent. It isn't understood fully by men and women alike in its depth and tenacity, but it's part of the same struggle. And not feeling a great deal of this, and not wanting to feel it, or not being capable of feeling it, leads us into making these nice distinctions. They should have used more peaceful means of expression. And yet, in our secret hearts, we understand that no one, probably in this room or this city or this state or this nation, would have ever given essentially one day's thought to prison conditions had it not been for those 43 deaths, that no one would really even feel the first twinge of understanding of what Native Americans go through had it not been for Wounded Knee. And the question, that's a hard one to answer for everyone, is when will people fight, kill, die, go into the valley for what they believe in and what they need? And when will the outside world begin to understand that this drive for survival is so powerful and so irresistible and so much a natural part of human or animal life that people will go to any length to preserve themselves and their brothers and sisters, and that to talk philosophically about it or abstractly has no meaning, whether you're talking about Palestinian Arabs or the people of Ulster and the Irish Republic, or of people in Vietnam, or in any of the former Portuguese colonies, or in Rhodesia, and the Union of South Africa, and so many other places that crop up in the newspapers almost as if they are a regular progression of each other. And not to understand it is to lead to greater tragedy. Because the counter value is to oppose it with force. The counter value is to destroy it without concerning yourself with its validity, its reasons for being. The counter value is to using the most philosophical and benign terms to consider only the part of it which affects our sensibilities without considering the part that comes out of the mainstream of people. And so we talk in different ways of different things. Tonight I was down at the Statler Hilton Hotel watching the demonstration around that hotel because the governor of this state, whose name for the moment escapes me, is a guest there. And a big, burly Buffalo police officer, and you know there are no bigger and no burlier anywhere in the world, dressed in a riot helmet, boots, and so on, said to me, "How's the trial going?" And I said, "Okay." He said, "You know, these people marching here today would have been encouraging us 5 years ago to break the heads of kids from the university, marching for other things." And he said, "You know," he said, "there are officers like myself," he said, "that are reluctant to carry a club in this city because we're not just going to break kids' heads in anymore." And he said he had been at Lafayette Square, I believe, on the Tuesday after the massacre at Attica when I spoke, and as soon as I left, the police officers came in and they broke heads that day in Lafayette Square for people demonstrating against what had happened at Attica the day before. And he said that he had also been on guard the other day when the hard hats surrounded Niagara Square and blocked traffic. And he said, "We would never have thought at Niagara Square to wade in and bust heads." He said, "Why did we delight in doing it 3.5 years earlier?" And at that moment, a photographer came in to take a picture of him and me talking. And he quickly moved away. But that's an interesting commentary, because it shows at least some attempt to think and ask questions. And apparently, this man, whom in another day I would have shrunk away from, has apparently been going through some process of understanding. And maybe it's more difficult for him to make that jump between the people around the Statler Hilton tonight and the students from this university 3.5 years ago. Unfortunately, our elders, the great mass of this country, those who really wield the power by not wielding it, the ones our late lamented Richard I used to call the silent majority, a phrase that Homer used to describe the dead in the Iliad. That mass, that inert mass, that zombieized mass of people are what lead to an Adolf Hitler or any other symbol of concentrated oppression. Because they do not reason or think, not because they're bad or evil people, but simply because the system has ground us up so much that to think of its institutions failing, to think of something that would radicalize or revolutionize this society is beyond them. They are victims of it, slaves of it. They have been spoon-fed for so long that we live in the greatest country in the world because we have the most refrigerators, that we live in the most moral country because on Saturdays and Sundays, people preach at us, people who rarely believe what they preach, but who preach anyway, and say things that sound good and noble, simply because we have documents that talk about due process and freedom of speech, equal protection of the laws, all the mythology of a dying country, simply because every 4th of July or equivalent day of rhapsodizing, people keep saying, we are moral and decent and good, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, and AT&T closed at 4:13. Because of this, we have now a very dangerous power vacuum. Those very values which the middle class cherishes no longer seem to have validity. Those very values which seem to hold the society together in a sort of a mythological umbilical cord, they have disappeared or are meaningless. And so many people are saying, give us somebody. Where is the white horse and the rider? Give us somebody that will pull us together. We can't do it with a used Ford. Give us somebody, some institution, some group. We're thirsting for names and leadership and faces. And at that moment, when that desire is that strong, that's when the horseback rider comes along. That's when Napoleon Premier is born. That's when the Third Reich came into being. We know now so much more about ourselves. We are no different than the Germans. 6 million Jews, 1 million Vietnamese. Is that a substantial difference? Malmedy Forest or My Lai 4? Are they one and the same? The defoliation of an entire peninsula for generations? Is that very different than guns over Poland? The utilization of endemic racism to try to destroy an Asiatic people, north and south, east and west? Is that very different than Aryan supremacy and Jewish genocide? Are we different than the burghers of Leipzig and Stuttgart, who knew that somewhere the gas ovens were burning and somewhere the cattle cars were rolling, to whom the names of Treblinka and Dachau and Auschwitz and Bergen-Belsen were mysterious places where bad things were done to other people than themselves? Are we so different from those people when we know so much what is done in our name and oppose it so feebly? Oppose it in the only way that will not jeopardize ourselves, by adopting the recommendations of the system that you don't attack it frontally and physically? You write to your congressman and he will do it for you. Are we all so different than that? Are the Germans less moral people, less vicious? Are we incapable of excesses as horrendous as the Third Reich's? Of course we are. All you have to see is a rerun of the movie about the commons at Kent State, or the streets of Jackson, Mississippi, around Jackson State College, or around Southern University, or Orangeburg, South Carolina, or My Lai 4, or Wounded Knee, or Attica. We don't have to go very far to see how easily we can become animals, and animals in the most derogatory sense of that word. And this is not done, I know now, by vicious, unprincipled people. It is done by people who pride themselves on their goodness and morality and decency, but who say, as they said in Germany and as they say here, we do it because we want to protect ourselves. What we are doing is right, because those who would disturb us must perforce be evil. And so every day a revelation of what we will do to each other, whether it's the destruction intended of the Socialist Workers' Party, or the labyrinth of telephone wiretaps and intercepts, or the COINTEL program of the FBI to destroy by all means necessary the forces of black liberation in this country, or whether it's the perversion of the courts to crucify an Angela Davis or a Benjamin Spock or a Bobby Seale or a John Hill or a Charlie Joe Panassilis. We see it all around us. We know it is in operation. We tolerate it. And only a few even intend to verbalize their feeling about it. And yet lurking inside of us must be the same primordial forces of self-preservation that brought on Wounded Knee and D-Yard at Attica. These forces are so strong that they cannot be suppressed by anything short of totalitarianism, and even then, not forever. And yet, the counterbalance of self-protection by others who are not oppressed in the visible sense of the word, but who live in secret fear that the blacks will break out of Harlem and come down Park Avenue that the American Indian will demand his and her due and threaten the false titles that were wrested from them when their treaties were broken 387 times in a row, or that the Puerto Ricans will overflow the bounds of the barrios in the Bronx and Manhattan, or that the Appalachian poor will somehow link up with Cesar Chavez and Jesse Jackson and Russell Means and will begin open warfare on the haves by those who have, as one rather celebrated economist observed, only their chains to lose. Guerrilla warfare exists in many areas of this country. You just have to read your local newspaper to see it here, as it is in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, and all the other urban centers. We have a small but vocal underground, primarily personified by the weather people. We have the turning of one daughter of the rich, Tanya, once known as Patricia Hearst, into a different human being. We have suburbanites beginning to talk in terms of revolution, abstract terms at the moment, but certainly not shying away from its discussion. We have people on one forum or another urging a reconsideration of the values and a reconsideration of the use of force, armed struggle, if you will, as the last resort in breaking the bonds. We have an undercurrent of revolution. If we're in any posture, we're in a pre-revolutionary posture. And at the same time, we have you and millions like you who have been so traumatized by the seemingly uselessness of protest and struggle, the seemingly useless attempt to attain a morality, so that you're slipping into the ashrams or into the graduate schools of the world. Anything to stay with clean and decent people as long as you can. And all of these forces, the great majority, wanting only peace and quiet, the students striving to remain where they feel there is love and warmth and human decency, knowing it doesn't exist essentially outside of these walls. And yet the oppressed are no less oppressed, the poor no less poor, the hungry no less hungry. And these forces interconnect. And where we will be in 10 years from tonight, very difficult to prophesize for anybody. In my way of thinking, there is only one way for people to live, and that is to struggle. It seems endless. Human beings get tired. Issues that seem once so clear and so golden become vague and tarnished. The compulsion is to become like our parents after a while. The compulsion is to lose yourself in some materialism, and that a house and a car and a television set and a motorboat will somehow give you back your heart and keep the harpies from gnawing on what's left of it. This is the enormous desire, understandably so, of so many human beings. Because if we can't beat it, let's join it. If we can't win, let's become part of it. After all, you only live once, so why not live it up? There is nothing afterwards except for those who believe there is, but most people are unwilling to take that chance. And so, gradually, long before the varicose veins, this syndrome has taken hold. And yet, fortunately, there are those who continue to fight. When they are gone, there is no use in anybody fighting. And that's why the men of Attica and the men, women, and children of Wounded Knee are so important for us. Not to chastise them with using methods which we say we wouldn't use, probably because we are not where they are and don't understand why what they do is necessary. That's why it is so important not to castigate them in prosaic and meaningless terms, but rather to say, what is it that made them decide that today was a beautiful day on which to die? What force within them generated that? Can I understand it when I am not part of it and have never been part of it? Can I understand it from sitting in the library here at the University of Buffalo or in my law office in New York? Can I understand at all? Or am I just talking gibberish and nonsense? Am I just like J. Alfred Prufrock? Do I dare? Do I dare? And most of us do not dare. And very few even understand. That's why Wounded Knee is an integral part of this nation. And that's why Attica shares that. 2 years apart from each other, different parts of the world, people who probably until this decade would never understand each other, people reaching the last limits of reasonable endurance. And perhaps if that kind of understanding permeates more of us, more will say to themselves, my vocation is liberty and freedom in its truest sense for all of us. My avocation is the way I make the shekels I need to feed myself with. And I don't need as many as I think. I can get along, particularly if I'm white and middle class. I can get along, but I must think in terms that are shorn of self-interest. Because unfortunately, self-interest is a factor so deep and so pervasive that it has almost become a rule of life in this country. Look after yourself. provide for yourself or for the small nuclear family, which has become a part of the social structure of this land. And care for others by depositing a small amount for the community chest. And yet there are those among us, and always have been, although the supply is not limitless, of those who will risk what Daniel Berrigan says is the risk of self-jeopardy, who will endure public risk, not for themselves, although you can't divorce the ego and other gratification, which is probably part of human life, but in some mystical way for everyone, and who are prepared to go down into the valley for their brothers and sisters. I guess that's why we're here tonight, because there have been those who have gone down in that valley so that we shall live. But all of that has no meaning if we live as zombies and ciphers, pursuing only a goal of acquiring more real estate or portfolios or television sets or social prestige and all the other meaningless values of life, the creature comfort aspect of our living. In 1890, a small band of Minneconjou Sioux tried to escape from our great white society into Canada. And they were led by a dying chief, dying of pleural pneumonia, by the name of Bigfoot. And he got them up into Nebraska, heading for the Canadian border. When he was rounded up, he and his 300 fellow citizens of this small band, by the 7th Cavalry, and they were escorted, is the word the orders use, but they were driven back to what was left of the Great Sioux Reservation in South Dakota. And the cavalry brought them across Nebraska, across the northern edge of South Dakota, finally, and then down to the bed of a little dry gulch called Wounded Knee. Today there is a hamlet there. In December of 1890, there was nothing there except the cold prairie wind. And when they reached the Wounded Knee Creek area, two Hotchkiss guns were set up on the ridges to the east and the west. And the colonel in charge of the 7th Cavalry ordered the weapons taken from the 50 or so braves who made up this little meandering band. And the cavalrymen went among the relatively young male population and began to snatch away their rifles. And they came to one who had just bought a new Winchester. And he was a deaf mute. And he didn't hear the command. And so the trooper seized the weapon. And the gun went off. A lieutenant was shot in the arm. The Hotchkiss guns opened up. And before you knew it, there were 300 red bodies on the ground. And 4 days later, they were buried in a common grave, just as 500 human beings, some 84 years later, were to have the same fate in a little hamlet 12,000 miles away called Mylai IV, done to death by the same agency, the United States Army. And some 10 or 12 miles away on that day was a holy man of the Oglala Sioux, a man by the name of Black Elk, who was then 27 years of age, and who heard reports of firing at Wounded Knee. And although he had been injured recently, rather severely, he got on a horse and he rode up to the creek bed. And by that time, a blizzard had developed, and those blizzards are quite intense. I lived through one in the same town in March of 1973. And it had covered the bodies before they could dig that common grave. And he rode among the bodies, and then he rode back to Pine Ridge. And 50 years later, when he was 77, a professor at the University of Nebraska by the name of John Neidhart, who died a year and a half ago at the age of 92, the poet laureate of that state. John Neidhart asked him in Lakota, in the language of the Sioux, how it was that day. And he said as follows, "And so it was all over. I did not know then how much was ended. When I look back now from this high hill of my old age, I can still see the butchered women and children lying heaped and scattered all along the crooked gulch, as plain as when I saw them with eyes still young. And I can see that something else died there in the bloody mud and was buried in the blizzard. A people's dream died there. And it was a beautiful dream. And I, to whom so great a vision was given in my youth, you see me now a pitiful old man who has done nothing. For the nation's hoop is broken and scattered. There is no center any longer, and the sacred tree is dead." That was 1890. In 1973, because 200 heroic and frightened people came back to that place of death and destruction and hung on for 71 days against the might of the same white invader, because of that incident, there is now a chance for Native Americans to survive. The birth rate is the highest in the land. They are creeping up to 1 million souls from the 250,000, the nadir of their existence here, from the 14 million estimated to have been on these shores when Columbus lost his way and found the new world. There is a new spirit. Alcoholism is being combated and is diminishing. Native American boys and girls are regaining a sense of self-worth. There is a fervor and a feeling that they are on the road to some future that holds more than the past. There is a feeling of fight and willingness to die and live. There are values that have meaning. and that would be understood so well in such places as Mozambique and Angola. There is a fight and a heart, and as Fred Hampton once said, the beat goes on. Does it go on with us? If Native Americans have been able to restore their center and water that dead tree that Black Elk saw, if they are able to restore the hoop by human courage and human devotion, can we not do otherwise? Are we so lost and gone that there's nothing left for us but the ability to acquire a sizable obituary and something called an estate to leave behind? Or will the beat go on? Will the beat of John Brown go on, and of Tom Paine, and of Robespierre, and of Gandhi, and of so many whose names are known to no one except themselves and a few? Will we be able to recapture a sense of something? Or are we a doomed and desperate people, betrayed beyond belief, who are just traveling the road because the road is there and we are on the road and there is no place to go but to follow the beaten path? I would hope that Wounded Knee lives forever. I would hope that the tragedy of Attica is more clearly understood, and that we as a people begin to understand that if there is to be a struggle, we must be part of that struggle. Then it cannot forever be fought by the tiny minorities, that the death can all not be heaped on the shoulders of those least able to bear them, that we middle-class people have a role in revolution, and that if this society cannot, through its institutions, give us a decent and fervent place in which to live and exist, then it should be torn down by one means or another and a new society tried. And that we must not be afraid to think in terms of radical and revolutionary alteration. No institution ever made by man or woman is given imperishable life. It has value only so long as it earns it. And when it loses it, the people must speak, and if words are not enough, they must act. If a prison becomes oppressive and nothing alters it, save the taking of hostages, then hostages will be taken. If a society becomes so oppressive that nothing will alter it except the seizing of a village, then villages will be seized. And those who say and stand in the way by saying, "You cannot do that," had better move out of the way before they are overwhelmed. Or better still, join those who struggle, because no struggle of that sort is confined in its effects to those who fight. The effects wash over you and me, and over the world we so often say we never made, but which we have the power to remake. if we only understood the nature of power and its employment. The men in Attica understood more than most of us what power is, and when it's needed, and how you seize it. The Native Americans at Wounded Knee understood exactly the same message, as have hundreds and thousands before them, and hopefully hundreds and thousands after them. I would like to close with a poem I have read in many places in Buffalo. It's only a portion of a poem. It says everything and nothing. I guess like so much of good prose or poetry, it has many meanings to many people. It was written by a man who left these shores because he could not stand them, and traveled throughout Europe. He had poured out his heart in one poem called John Brown's Body, when he tried to personify for Americans what the slave struggle was all about, and what a man called John Brown was all about. And for those of you who are interested, the Weather Underground has just published the first issue of its underground magazine, and they have called it Osawatomie, named after the name given to John Brown, Old Osawatomie. And after Stephen Vincent Benet wrote that poem, he then began to travel abroad. And while he was abroad, he began to think back over the meaning of American civilization. To him, for the moment, an expatriate wandering the face of Europe. And he wrote a poem called American Names. And I commend the entire poem to you. But the last six lines, I guess, are the lines that are the ones that have had most significance to me. And you all know one of those lines, as you'll learn in a minute. But think of the poet, the wandering abroad, the society in which we live and have lived, the responsibilities we have to ourselves and each other, and the concept of perpetual struggle of any people to remain free, and free in the true sense of the word. Stephen Vincent Benet ended his poem, American Names, by saying as follows: I shall not go back to Montparnasse. I shall not rest easy in Winchelsea. You may bury my body in Sussex grass. You may bury my tongue at Chamedy, but I shall not be there. I shall rise and pass, bury my heart at Wounded Knee. Thank you.